Hello and welcome to Audio Reader Sports Show. My name is Steve Jack, and today we'll read from the April 2026 issue of Sports Illustrated. Our first article is a preview of the Masters, and while the Masters did conclude last weekend with Rory McIlroy winning his second green jacket, we'll read from the preview article from SI first, and then get an update from ESPN.com on this year's Masters results. Shuffling along, the Masters is just around the corner, which means the 2026 golf season is about to heat up. Can anyone slow Scottie Scheffler's roll? Has Rory McIlroy peaked? Our golf staff tells all. We have some photographs by Eric W. Rasko, and the first one shows Scottie Scheffler swinging away from a tee at the U.S. Open, and the caption, "Happy Feet." Last year, Scheffler won his third and fourth career majors and topped the money list for the fourth straight year. Shuffling along. Okay, let's start off with a little fact or fiction. First up, Rory McIlroy is the defending champion at the Masters, finally. Having removed that 2-ton weight from his shoulders last year, he will eventually end his career with multiple green jackets. Bob Herring, SI Golf senior writer. Fiction. Perhaps that burden-lifting victory frees him up to win more. It's certainly possible, but there are no guarantees, obviously, and McIlroy might be better suited by adding a different major or two, especially the British Open. Jeff Ritter, SI Golf Managing Director. Fiction. Oh, sure, he might win another one, maybe even this year. So why bait a bet against a generational future Hall of Famer? Because it took him so long to bag his first. Because there are new stars blossoming every spring. And because of Father Time, McIlroy turns 37 in May, and his career peak is either already behind him or ending soon. Max Schreiber, SI Golf Contributing Writer. Fiction. It's not a crazy take to say McIlroy will win at Augusta again, but after finally breaking through in 2025, the five-time major champion admitted he was struggling to find motivation. Surely he wants to claim another Masters, but it appears his career goals have shifted toward winning at other historic venues, the 2027 British Open at St. Andrews in particular. John Schwarb, SI Golf Senior Editor. Fact. Surprised I'm writing solo on this. I never thought McIlroy would get the first green jacket, but there's no reason to think in a few years, maybe even in his 40s, that he won't grab another just through course knowledge and guile. We've seen that before, no? Augusta National was 7,555 yards on the scorecard for the 2025 Masters, and no one has won with a score worse than 10 under since 2027. It's time for Masters officials to add more length or make other significant changes to the hallowed grounds. Herrig, fiction. Augusta National has already pushed the boundaries of what is rational. The club bought land behind Amen Corner so it could lengthen the 13th hole. The tee box at number 11 is so far back you could get lost in the woods trying to find it. It purchased part of a road to extend the 5th hole. Enough is enough. Augusta might actually make a statement by adhering to the 2028 ball rollback, which will decrease distances by about 5%. Which would be a mighty stand. Ritter, fiction. Why bother? The Masters reliably delivers thrilling finishes where players can make fast moves up the leaderboard or crash and burn. No course adjustments are necessary. It's already the exact kind of show Augusta aims for, and golf fans devour. Schreiber, fiction. In recent years, the course has been lengthened, but how much more can it take? Perhaps a more realistic way to combat golf's distance issue is the rollback of the ball. Maybe that'll eventually extend to equipment, too. But don't expect the return of persimmon drivers. Schwab, fiction. As Bob said, Masters officials can do what no one else can, calling their own shots on a rolled-back tournament ball. I wouldn't mind seeing that, plus elimination of the second gut, allowing errant shots to roll into trouble. There has not been a first-time Masters participant to win since Fuzzy Zeller in 1979, but that streak will not reach 50 years. Herrig, fiction. There's a reason it hasn't happened. The pressure, the necessary course knowledge, the various nuances have all conspired to make rookie winners a rarity. Even Fuzzy needed help from Ed Snead, who bogeyed the last three holes to fall into a sudden-death playoff. Ritter, fiction. Chris Goderup looks like a dangerous first-time participant, but course knowledge is clearly a huge factor. With so many wily veterans in the field each year, I'd bet against a rookie breakthrough anytime soon. Schreiber, fiction. In the last 4 years, the hottest player in golf entering the Masters has gone on to win. Scheffler, Rahm, Scheffler, McIlroy. As of late February, that's Goderup, who's made improvements with his ball striking, which is imperative in Augusta. However, when predicting if Zeller's streak will be broken this year, it's a safer bet to say no. Schwab, fact. Seeing Anthony Kim win in February, his first win in 16 years, which included a long hiatus from the sport, has me thinking that anything is possible and new fearless players emerge every year. If you're giving me the next four Masters to cash this in, I'll take a shot. But can I have 40-1 odds, too? And there's our next picture that accompanies the article. It's a picture of a determined Brandel DeChambeau with his fist clenched after making a putt, with his caddy standing behind him. And the caption, "Living large." DeChambeau, who had three top 10 finishes in last year's majors, is reportedly seeking $500 million to re-up with LIV after this season. Golf Channel commentator Brandel Chambly stirred the pot in February by saying the Players' Championship stood above the four majors and, in fact, is the best major. Herrig, fiction. The best one to me is always the one being played. Ritter, fiction. Bob nailed it. There's nothing better than the major that's currently being played. Right now, in the midst of the Masters hype train, I can't wait to get to Augusta. Schreiber, neutral. It depends on what you're into. The U.S. Open is a war of attrition. The Masters is for the shot-making artists, and the British Open requires creativity with the ball, too, in gnarly conditions. Though, if the weather is benign, scores will be low. However, there's one thing most can agree on. The PGA Championship is a distant fourth. Schwab, fiction. The U.S. Open can be the best golf tournament at the right course, like an Oakmont or Shinnecock this year. It's a delight to see who perseveres and who unravels. And it being a true Open gives us wonderful storylines in the early rounds every year. But the Masters has become such a rite of spring in sports, with traditions and exclusivity that will have reached mythic levels, that it stands alone if we're ranking them. Jack Nicklaus, of course, is the all-time leader with 6 green jackets, and Tiger Woods is next with 5. Someone in this year's field will eventually join those two with at least 5 titles. Herrig, fact. Why not Scottie Scheffler? In 6 Masters appearances, he has 2 wins and has never been worse than 19th. Without anywhere near his best stuff, he still finished 4th last year. It won't be easy winning 3 more green jackets, but he certainly seems capable of giving himself numerous opportunities over the next decade. Ritter, fiction. Scheffler is the best and perhaps only candidate since he's on top of the world and already has 2 jackets. He may one day get there, but I think Jack and Tiger are more likely to stand alone on the Masters leaderboard for the next generation. Schreiber, fact. Scheffler can do it. He only needs three more. He tends to play better on courses he's seen before. And, of course, the Masters is the lone major that's annually played at the same venue. Schwarb, fact. Like Bob said, it's about having plenty of at-bats remaining, and Scheffler has one more Masters in his 20s and all of his 30s ahead. Nicklaus picked off two in his 30s and the improbable one at 46. The Masters is famous for its inexpensive and simple concessions. The $1.50 pimento cheese sandwich is the one must-have when attending. Herrig, fiction. To each his own, but that sandwich is borderline gross. I'll go with the egg salad every time. Ritter. Fiction. Pimento gets all the press, but savvy patrons know that a classic chicken sandwich for $3 is the real star. Schreiber. Fiction. Considering I'm a Yankee from the New York area, I've never actually had it. One day that'll change, and then I probably won't ever try it again. Schwarb, fiction. I'm not eating my mother's pimento cheese, so sorry I'm not eating this version either. I'll be alongside Jeff eating more classic chicken sandwiches than you need to know about. This year, LIV Golf players who finished in the top 10 of their events are receiving official world golf ranking points, which will help unlock access to majors. The league also moved to a 72-hole format and added some new sponsors. On the other hand, it lost Patrick Reed and Brooks Koepka, but the league's entire future hangs on whether Bryson DeChambeau comes back in 2027. Herrig, fiction. LIV Golf can go on for as long as the public investment fund is willing to absorb massive losses. Yes, losing DeChambeau would hurt, but you can also argue that despite its huge popularity and amazing run of golf in the majors over the past 3 years, he's not moved the financial needle much for LIV Golf. That's what makes this situation fascinating. LIV doesn't want to lose Bryson, but if his asking price is anything near the large numbers being thrown around, $500 million, does LIV believe the investment is worth it? Ritter, fact. Bob, you're half right. LIV will indeed last for as long as its investors are willing to continue, but if DeChambeau walks, it's over. Schreiber, fact. With or without DeChambeau, LIV is already flailing. Lackluster television ratings, over $1 billion in international losses, and its biggest off-season signings, Thomas Dentry, Victor Perez, Elvis Smiley, and reigning NCAA champion Michael Lissasso. If DeChambeau leaves, it'll be the nail in the coffin. Schwarb, fact. LIV Golf won't fold up its luxury suites immediately if it lost DeChambeau, but the clock would start on the end, because if Bryson goes, John Rahm would likely be next, and there's no one else in the LIV stable right now that can carry the show. All right, let's get to some predictions, starting with the upcoming Masters. Who wins and why? Herrig, Scottie Scheffler. He's on an Arnold Palmer-like every even year run. Arnie did it in 1958, 60, 62, and 64. I like that trend continuing. Ritter, Tommy Fleetwood. The chalk says Scheffler, but I love everything about how Fleetwood has continued to thrive after breaking through for his first career PGA Tour title at the FedEx Final last August. Schreiber, Scheffler. He's Scotty Scheffler, enough said. Schwarb, Scheffler. I hate picking chalk, but Scheffler is the exception, like Tiger was a generation ago, like it was back then. Everyone else in the field now looks for Scotty on the leaderboard, and if he's above them, it's a sinking feeling. There are a couple of photographs, the first one of Anthony Kim chipping out of a bunker with sand flying all around him, and a second one of Tommy Fleetwood, eyes focused on the ball as he tracks his ball after a big swing. And the caption for these two photos, building blocks, big things could be in store for Fleetwood, who finally won on tour in 2025, and Kim, whose February Live win was his first pro title since 2010. How about the summer's other three majors? The PGA Championship is Aronimic outside of Philly. Herrig, Keegan Bradley. He's won at Aronimic, the 2018 BMW, and perhaps by then he will have put that pain of the Ryder Cup behind him. Ritter, Anthony Kim. Bold? Definitely. Impossible? Hardly. As of this writing, Kim would need to make a big move up the official world golf ranking to climb into the top 100 in auto qualify. But the PGA also gives a few special exemptions each year, so they could dish an invitation Kim's way. And then, game on. Raw tee box power is not mandatory for success at Aronimic. Enter Kim, who relies on guile, swagger, and a hot putter. Anything can generally happen at the PGA, and AK could turn this event upside down. Schreiber, Chris Goddard. Aronimic is going to play long in the moist spring northeast. Goddard can certainly bomb it, and if he keeps up his solid iron play, he can roll that into a major win less than 2 hours from where he grew up in New Jersey. Schwarb, Justin Rose. The Englishman won a PGA Tour event at Aronimic in 2010, AT&T National, and is playing the best golf of his life in his 40s. Rose nearly derailed Rory last year at Augusta, and he'll finally get his second major here. Okay, the U.S. Open is at Shinnecock. Who you got? Herrig. John Rahm. He missed the cut at Shinnecock in 2018, but that was before Rahm was, well, Rahm. Since then, he's been on a nice run at the U.S. Open with four top tens, including his 2021 victory. Ritter. Scheffler. He's on career Grand Slam watch after winning the British last summer, and he'll quickly finish it off. Shinnecock will be set up on a knife's edge, and the winner will need to excel in all phases. Sounds like Scheffler's music. Schreiber. Fleetwood. It might seem obvious because he's finished as runner-up at Shinnecock in 2018, one stroke back of Brooks Koepka, but since breaking through at East Lake last August, Fleetwood seems to be in form. Schwarb, Scheffler. The Grand Slam Club had been closed for 25 years until Rory opened it back up. Now, just a year later, another member will arrive, and Scheffler winning on his 30th birthday and Father's Day with son Bennett running out to greet him on the 18th green? Sign me up. And the British Open at Royal Birkdale? Herrig. Fleetwood. The Englishman now lives in Dubai, but Southport is his hometown, and Royal Birkdale seems a good place for him to win his first major. Ritter. Robert McIntyre, the big-hitting lefty, is fearless and, most importantly, has become a more consistent and versatile player as he settles in. He flashed on Sunday in the U.S. Open last summer and had a strong Ryder Cup for Europe in the fall. Schreiber. McIntyre. I echo Jeff here. In six British Open starts, the Scot has three top tens, including last year, plus winning the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship at St. Andrews last October in blustery conditions proves he has what it takes to win a claret jug. Schwarb. Fleetwood. A year after his first win, he'll take his first major in front of an adoring home crowd in Southport. Give us one bold prediction, something bordering ridiculous, but in an era of absurd golf headlines, one that still could happen in the year ahead. Herrig. Kim wins a professional event. Yes, it has already occurred, but nothing more ridiculous than that can happen the rest of the year. Ritter. Patrick Reed wins the Masters. I picked Fleetwood above, but golf's ultimate loner is now without a tour and back in FU mode, right in his comfort zone. Schreiber. McIlroy doesn't win on the PGA Tour. The hangover from his indelible emotional 2025 will creep into this season. Schwarb. PGA Tour CEO Brian Rolapp lifts all tour suspensions near the end of 2026, having watched Koepka come back from LIV Golf and win a tour event. Reed energized the previously moribund President's Cup, and Kim win twice on the rival tour. The boss declares that anyone who played any time on LIV is welcome back with open arms in 2027. And this related article, roller coasting to victory. 1 year ago, Rory McIlroy became the sixth golfer to join the sport's most revered group, career Grand Slam winners, with an invigorating and harrowing Sunday round at Augusta that was unlike any other. And there is a photograph of Royal McIlroy. He's leaning back as he puts on the green jersey at last year's Masters, and the caption, Slam Funk. McIlroy went 11 years between major wins with 21 top 10 finishes before last year's victory at Augusta. And this article is written by Bob Herring. In the aftermath of an exhilarating final day at the Masters last April, Rory McIlroy never had occasion to look in his golf bag until he traveled home. And when he finally did, his 7-iron was missing. That's a pretty important club, he said. Indeed, it played a huge role in his victory, as he used it for a shot that will live in Masters lore, a sweeping hook around a tree from 208 yards on the 15th hole during the final round, which set up a birdie that tied him for the lead. Again, in the 20 or so minutes preceding that shot, McIlroy, along with fans who agonizingly hoped for him to achieve his long-awaited career Grand Slam, passed through an emotional gauntlet. Before that shot on 15, he was teetering on the verge of a historic implosion. McIlroy, who began the day two shots ahead of Bryson DeChambeau, led by 4 shots when he teed off on Augusta's iconic par 5 13th. McIlroy laid up his second shot to 86 yards and then, fearing he might pull his shot left, dumped that basic wedge shot into the small creek fronting the green, leading to a double bogey 7. I cannot believe he let it squirt out to the right. I don't care what he does. Chunk it into the grass, says Jack Nicklaus, the 6-time Masters champ. The ball is going to roll down to the hole, but you cannot do what he did. Pardon the expression, that's a brain fart. In the morning of the first round, Nicklaus, now 86, had shared that he met with McIlroy prior to the tournament, and they talked about his strategy leading up to the Masters. I said, Rory, I know you prepared for Augusta. Tell me how you're going to play the golf course, Nicklaus said. We went through it shot for shot. He got done talking about the round, and I didn't open my mouth. I said, well, I wouldn't change a thing. That's exactly the way I would try to play the golf course. Nicklaus chuckles at the idea of McIlroy deviating from his stated strategy at times during the final round while he had the whole golfing world and mountains on his shoulders. McIlroy didn't make that burden any easier when he bogeyed the 14th hole, missing a 6-footer to fall a shot behind Justin Rose. And then, after he hit that great approach on 15, he missed the 6-footer for eagle, but still walked away with a birdie. He had just 9 feet after another great approach at the 16th, but missed the birdie putt. On 17, he left himself a putt he couldn't miss after hitting an 8-iron approach to a matter of inches to take a 1-shot lead. Now, all McIlroy needed was a par 18 for that elusive jacket, and after a perfect drive, he had just a gap wedge left, and he dumped the shot into the right bunker. A blast to 4 feet left him that close to victory, and he missed the putt. During the final round, McIlroy made 2 double bogeys, 6 birdies, and 3 bogeys. On a day when 72 would have won, he shot 73. It was just a complete roller coaster of a day, he said. There were points on the back 9 when I thought, Have I let this slip again? But I responded with some clutch shots. He delivered one more on 18 during the sudden death playoff. Rose hit his approach to 15 feet. McIlroy countered with a wedge to less than 4 feet. Rose missed and dead silence ensued as, again, McIlroy had a short putt to win. Nobody believed it was a gimme, a collective holding of breath commencing throughout the property. Finally, the ball fell into the cup. McIlroy tossed his putter and dropped to his knees. It was all relief, he said. There wasn't much joy in that reaction. It was all relief. And then the joy came pretty soon after that. But that was, I've been coming to the Masters 17 years, it was a decade plus of emotion that came out of me there. In 2011, McIlroy was just 21 when he held a four-shot final round Masters lead and then imploded over the back nine. He subsequently won 4 majors in the space of 4 years, putting him a green jacket shy of a career Grand Slam. When he finally broke through, it would be hard to fathom a Masters final round carrying more dread, more elation, and ultimately more joy. As for that missing 7-iron, unbeknownst to McIlroy, his agent, Sean O'Flaherty, had plucked it from his bag amid all the celebration. He gave it to Augusta National for display in the clubhouse, a common tradition by Masters champions. If there was one I was going to give the club, McIlroy said, it was probably that one. And that was last year. This year, we'll read from ESPN.com about what happened last weekend. Rory McIlroy wins Masters, first to repeat since Tiger Woods. And Mark Schlembach of ESPN.com wrote our article. From Augusta, GA, Rory McIlroy had to wait more than a decade to win the Masters and complete the career Grand Slam. He had to wait only a year to take home a second green jacket. After squandering a record 6-stroke lead in Saturday's third round, McIlroy briefly lost the lead again Sunday before taking control on the second nine at Augusta National to become the first back-to-back Masters champion since Tiger Woods in 2001-02 and fourth overall, Jack Nicklaus and Nick Faldo. A day after his 1-over-73 opened the door for a handful of golfers, McIlroy posted a 71, despite a bogey on the 18th to win by 1 stroke at 12-under-276. I thought it was so difficult to win last year because of trying to win the Masters and the Grand Slam, and then this year I realized it's just really difficult to win the Masters, McIlroy said. I tried to convince myself it was both. McIlroy became only the fourth golfer in the past 40 years to hold a lead or co-lead after each round of the Masters, according to ESPN research. With his 6th major championship victory, the Northern Ireland native joined England's Faldo for second most among European golfers. Only England's Harry Vardon won more with 7 from 1896 to 1914. As with last year, this Masters victory didn't come without some drama on the 18th hole. Holding a 2-stroke lead, McIlroy badly sliced his drive into the trees on the right, his ball nearly reaching the edge of the 10th fairway. Standing in pine straw, McIlroy hooked an 8-iron high over the trees into the left bunker at the 18th. He punched out to 12 feet and 2-putted for a bogey and 1-shot victory over world number 1 Scottie Scheffler, who finished at 11-under. There wasn't much to say to caddy Harry Diamond, McIlroy said, of the drive on 18. I think we were both just hoping that my ball wasn't in a really bad spot or behind a tree. I was just hoping that I had a swing. Thanks to 2 late birdies, Scheffler closed with a 68 and became the first golfer since World War II to play bogey-free in the final 2 rounds of the Masters. Tyrell Hatton, who plays in LIV Golf, tied for third at 10 under with Russell Henley, Justin Rose, and Cameron Young. I hit it amazing today, Henley said. I gave myself a bunch of looks. Unfortunately, I didn't capitalize on those looks on the back like I would have liked to. I felt like I handled the pressure well, handled the conditions well. It was tricky out there. McIlroy looked to be in trouble early in his round. After making a birdie on the par 4 third, he 3-putted for a double bogey on par 3 fourth to drop to 10 under. A bogey on the par 3 sixth dropped him to 9 under, 2 shots behind Young. The early mistakes had McIlroy looking at scoreboards throughout his round. I felt like I needed to, especially after the rough start, he said. I needed to know where I was in the tournament. And after the sixth hole, I was like, okay, if I can get back to even par for the day, which I did with the birdies on 7 and 8, I knew I was going to be right in there going into the back 9. I was keeping an eye all day. Thankfully, there were a few guys that made a run, but nothing like what Justin did last year with that 66. Some good play by me, and fortunately, the guys didn't really come at me this year either. McIlroy took control at Amen Corner, Augusta National's famous three-hole stretch from numbers 11 to 13. He made par on the par 4, 11th, to maintain a one-shot lead over 4 golfers, then hit his tee shot with a 9-iron high over the par 3, 12th green. His ball landed and kicked right, stopping 7 feet from the hole. McIlroy's birdie putt broke right and dropped in the cup for a 2-shot lead. Then on the par 5, 13th, McIlroy crushed a 350-yard drive down the right side, leaving him 183 yards from the hole. His approach shot bounced off the back of the green about 22 yards away. McIlroy putted down the green to 11 feet and made a birdie putt for a 3-stroke lead with 5 holes to play. I think the tee shot on 12 and then the tee shot on 13 just to give me the option to go for the green in 2, McIlroy said when asked if any shot stood out Sunday. I struggled with that tee shot all week. I was up in the pine straw there one too many times, and I made a really good committed swing off the 13th tee, and that enabled me to go for the green in 2 to make a birdie there following the birdie on 12. That was massive. Rose, a 3-time runner-up at Augusta National after losing to McIlroy in a playoff last year, started the final round 3 strokes behind McIlroy and Young, but he closed the first 9 with 3 straight birdies to move to 12 under for a 2-stroke lead when he made the turn. But it was another devastating finish for Rose. On the 11th, he pushed his approach shot far to the right. He chipped over a bunker on his 3rd shot and couldn't make a 15-footer for par. The bogey dropped him to 12 under, tying him with McIlroy. Rose's tee shot on 12th was long and left. Somehow he chunked his chip shot from behind the green, leaving his ball in the rough. He putted to 5 feet and made another bogey, falling 1 behind McIlroy. The 45-year-old, who was attempting to become the second oldest Masters champion, seemed to regain momentum on his approach on the par 5 15th. From 197 yards, Rose took an aggressive line and his ball bounced onto the green and stopped 30 feet from the hole. But Rose missed an eagle putt, then an 8-foot birdie try, and had to settle for a 3-putt par, leaving him 2 behind McIlroy. I think just a chance that got away, obviously, Rose said. You know, I was by no means kind of free and clear and was nowhere kind of close to having the job done, but I was right in position, you know, Amen Corner, without really hitting a bad shot, but just not a good shot, not committed enough on maybe the 11th approach shot specifically. It was kind of like 2 saves. Scheffler put himself back in the hunt for a 3rd green jacket with a 7-under 65 on Saturday. He made 2 early birdies in the final round, but then carded 11 straight pars before the birdies at numbers 15 and 16. Overall, I'm not going to hold too many regrets, but yeah, definitely a bit disappointed now, he said. But like I said, I started the weekend 12 shots back and ended up only one shot back. If I'm going to blame anything, I should probably blame the first two rounds before I start looking at stuff from the last couple. Switching sports from golf to Formula One racing, American Revolution, a new team is joining the Formula One grid as Cadillac makes its debut this season, but that's not the only change to keep an eye on in the circus of circuits. And there is a photograph of a Formula One race car. The sun is gleaming against the top hood. Test drive, Cadillac is using a Ferrari engine in 2026, but plans to have its own power unit by 29. American Revolution by Zach Coons, courtesy of Cadillac Formula One team. 366 days. That's the amount of time the Cadillac Formula One team was given between receiving formal approval to become the sport's 11th constructor in 2026 and lining up a car on the grid for the season's opening race at the Australian Grand Prix. That accelerated timeline and 11th hour uncertainty has defined the General Motors-backed entry into F1. Even though the process began well before Cadillac emerged as the brand that would earn a spot in the highest class of racing. But utilizing that time remains the key for team principal Graham Loudon, who has been involved with the project since he took a phone call in his car in the spring of 2022, well over 1,000 days ago. And every second is still precious. Sleep's an optional extra until Christmas, Loudon says, ahead of Cadillac's inaugural season. The most important voices that Loudon heard on the call belong to former F1 world champion Mario Andretti and his son Michael, co-owner of Andretti Global, the organization bidding to get a spot in the sport. Loudon was meant to bring his expertise as one of the self-proclaimed rare animals who already had gone through the process of launching a new team with Virgin Racing in 2010. On the call, he did exactly that, advising the Andrettis and various investors on how the International Automobile Federation, FIA, process would work and what would need to be done in order to meet the rigorous guidelines. At the end of the call came a message to Loudon from Mario, the second and last American to win an F1 Drivers' Championship in 1978. "Don't let me down." That would be just the beginning for Loudon, who came aboard as an advisor. After the initial bid was met with resistance from both F1 and the sport's 10 established teams, Michael Andretti stepped down from his role at the forefront of the operation in late 2024. The decision cleared the way for General Motors, with its Cadillac brand, to take command of the bid, with TWG Motorsports CEO Dan Tauris at the helm. Through it all, Loudon remained steadfast in his commitment to get a new team into the sport. After his previous attempt, which ended with Virgin going through numerous rebrands before ending up in severe debt and folding after the 2016 season, the 60-year-old has stayed around F1. "I'd like to think I've got the antibodies in terms of a lot of the things that would normally be a surprise," he said. And on December 5th, 2024, Loudon was given another chance as the team principal at Cadillac. 92 days later, F1 approved the team's entry. "One of the key reasons why we're here is that the investors had their belief in the project and invested at the right level, which was substantial," I hasten to add, "with no guarantee of an entry," Loudon says. From there, Cadillac's official countdown clock began, but the work was already well underway. F1 is no stranger to fluctuations in the number of teams that enter each season, with as many as 12 outfits competing as recently as 2012. But the grid has been rather stable for the past decade, with 10 constructors comprising the field since 2017. There's no how-to manual for where a new team should begin. You can download all the regulations off the internet, but there's nothing that indicates how do you enter as a new team, Loudon says. So Cadillac focused its efforts on a logical place to start, people. Loudon and Taurus received 143,265 applications from those eager to get involved in building an F1 team from scratch. Cadillac shortlisted 9,051 candidates and interviewed somewhere in the region of 6,500, Loudon said. At the end of 2025, the staff hovered at about 525 full-time employees, with the number of contractors and partners spread across three primary locations: the team's satellite facility in Silverstone, UK, as well as U.S. hubs in Fishers, Indiana, and Charlotte. Of course, the team's most forward-facing employees will be behind the wheel, and Cadillac made sure to go after figures who would be familiar to F1 fans of the past decade: Valtteri Bottas and Sergio Chico Perez. The two veterans bring a wealth of experience to the team, with a combined 26 years on the F1 circuit, 106 podium finishes, and 16 race wins. Waiting in the wings is reserve driver Zoe Gonia, who raced for three seasons alongside Bottas and Alfa Romeo and Sauber. His manager at the time, Loudon. "I feel like it's always a very special moment when you're with a team from the very beginning," says Zhao, who was born in Shanghai and moved to England when he was 12. "So you're building up together, the whole team, and an F1 performing together, which is very exciting." While this may be the beginning for Cadillac, it's far from it for most involved. The Finnish-born Bottas ran as the number two driver in seven-time world champion Lewis Hamilton while at Mercedes until 2022, when he moved to Alfa Romeo, which later operated as Sauber. But he did not score a single point in any of the 24 races in 24 and went back to Mercedes last season as a reserve driver. Perez, the first Mexican driver to win a race in 50 years, similarly sat behind four-time champion Max Verstappen at Red Bull, supporting the team's constructors' championships in 22 and 23. After a difficult 24 season, however, Perez was left without an opportunity to drive. Zoe served as the reserve driver at Ferrari last season, following a similarly difficult tenure at Sauber. All three drivers had spent time with F1's elite, and yet going into 2026 were without a secure spot in the sport. There was speculation that Cadillac would sign an American driver in an effort to appeal to fans looking to get behind a new team. IndyCar star Colton Herta did make the leap to become the team's test driver and race in Formula 2 with Cadillac's support, but he will still need significant time before he's ready to sit in one of the 22 most coveted seats in racing. There was little doubt in Loudon's mind about the choices of Bottas and Perez, and once the team got the glimpse of its car at preseason testing in Barcelona, he was completely convinced. "Halfway through the Barcelona test, I sat on the pit wall listening to comments that won't mean an awful lot to anybody listening in, but meant a lot to me because there were kind of comments that come from highly experienced drivers," Loudon said. "They have a level of maturity, both when they're talking in technical terms and also the way that they're prioritizing feedback. It's very clear that they have a lot of experience, and also the way that they're motivating and encouraging the teammates around them. Though there may not be an American behind the wheel, The red, white, and blue clearly runs deep in the DNA of what Cadillac is trying to achieve off the track. Marketing efforts have directly targeted a U.S. audience following the sports boom in the country since the start of the decade. Those efforts culminated in a 30-second advertisement that aired during Super Bowl 60, another endeavor that came under a time crunch. Chief Marketing Officer Ahmed Kubal says the spot, which unveiled Cadillac's inaugural livery, came together in less than 90 days. The ad connected to an in-person activation in the middle of Times Square in New York City, again in an attempt to emphasize the American roots of the team. Most notably, though, the Super Bowl clip featured a snippet of John F. Kennedy's 1962 "We Choose to Go to the Moon" speech, invoking the Apollo missions, which the Cadillac operation seems to feel a certain kinship with. Kubal calls the effort behind the ad, as well as the entire team, a moonshot driven by American ingenuity and audacious ambition. We're trying to do something, not first, but we're trying to do it fast, and we're trying to do it the best, Kubal says. It's one of those iconic American moments that I think got everyone together in this country to be like, yeah, this is worth doing, it's worth going, it's worth trying to innovate and do this crazy thing that many think is not possible. Fielding an F1 team certainly doesn't require the same calculations or logistics as landing an astronaut on the moon, but the collaborative effort across time zones and oceans has been immense. It's part of what Loudon calls the leap into the unknown that Cadillac has taken. Yet the experience that comes from the staff surrounding the drivers helps limit the question marks. Chief Technical Officer Nick Chester held a similar role at Renault. Former Alpine Operations Director Robert White is the team's Chief Operating Officer. Consultant Pat Simmons was the Chief Technical Officer at F1 from 2017 to 2024, with stops at Renault, Marussia, and Williams. Again, a Loudon connection also on his resume. We don't just have everyone starting from scratch, Zoe says. We have experienced people, experienced knowledge, experienced engineers, which makes the difference because F1 is so complicated. You need to get everything right as a team, and that takes time. Time, something that Cadillac has been short on for the past year. And yet, two cars will pull out of the garage and onto the tracks at 24 different Grand Prix in 2026. When they do, there's no telling exactly how they'll fare. As is customary every few seasons in the sport, the FIA introduced new technical regulations this winter that will reset the competitive balance of the field. There's no guarantee that McLaren, which dominated last season en route to Lando Norris's first world championship, will be atop the pecking order again. For Cadillac, competing with recent powerhouses like Red Bull or Mercedes, or historic operations like Ferrari or McLaren, seems like an uphill battle. F1 isn't a sport where teams can inhibit the opposition, but rather control the things that are within our scope and within our ability, Loudon says. Yet there's a new kid on the block sort of attitude with Cadillac. Hungry, with an upstart mentality, those within the building have aspirations of shaking up the sport. Put it plainly, Cadillac F1 has nothing to lose. I think the best way to think of it is actually to put ourselves in the shoes of the opposition, Loudon says. There's not a team on that grid that hasn't been doing this for at least a decade, if not decades. And I'm pretty sure their shareholders would be somewhat upset if we just turn up and start beating their team. In fact, they may be more than upset. They would be apoplectic. Cadillac's time to prove itself has been rapidly approaching, and now that it's here, there's clearly no signs of slowing down. Pit stops. From regulation changes to uncertain futures for several drivers, these are the top storylines for the 2026 F1 season. New regs, skeptical reactions. F1 introduced new regulations for 2026, replacing the drag reduction system with overtake mode and increasing electrification in motors. But there are already skeptics. Among them is Max Verstappen, who blasted the cars, calling them anti-racing. Charles Leclerc expressed concern that it may be extremely difficult to overtake without depleting batteries. If both drivers proved correct, the new season could get off to a rough start. Verstappen's murky future. An up-and-down season and inner turmoil at Red Bull in 2025 made many wonder, could Verstappen leave the team he spent his entire career with? The four-time world champ may have that very option after this upcoming season. The 28-year-old has threatened early retirement in the past, and if the new regulations aren't to his liking, there's a possibility he could walk away for a year or more. Is Mercedes the team to beat? Since Lewis Hamilton's run of dominance came to an end on the final lap of the 2021 season, the Silver Arrows have wandered into the wilderness. But early indications suggest Mercedes got the jump on the field with its new engine, so much so that rivals have already called its legality into question. George Russell is now a bona fide veteran, and if 19-year-old Kimi Antonelli can take a leap in his second season, Mercedes could be dangerous. Ferrari Hamilton bounce back. The most historic team in F1 has gone nearly two decades without a championship. Plus, Hamilton is in the twilight of his career, and his first year with Ferrari saw him finish a disappointing sixth. The team has been coy about its chances in 2026, but did debut an innovative rotating rear wing during testing in Bahrain, a sign that it is willing to try anything to get back on top. How McLaren enforces papaya rules. Much was made about how the back-to-back constructors' champions handled prioritizing, or rather not prioritizing, Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri in 2025. Ultimately, Norris won his first title, and Piastri faded into third place. But McLaren's driver indecision let Verstappen back into the fray. Will Norris get the benefit of the doubt now that he's the reigning champ, or will McLaren stick to a dicey status quo? Familiar faces, very few different places. The previous offseason was filled with so much driver momentum that this past winter paled in comparison. Isaac Haydar is the only driver to move teams from Racing Bulls to Red Bull. After being left out in 2025, multi-time race winners Sergio Perez and Valtteri Bottas are the faces of Cadillac's inaugural season. And Arvid Lindblad, who replaced Haydar, is the lone rookie in the field of 22. Next, scorecard history. You using that? There's a long tradition of athletes and second-hand gear. This is written by Mark Bechtel. During a casual round of golf earlier this winter, Colin Morikawa borrowed a putter from one of his playing partners, Daniel Kitayama. I said, "Oh, let me try it," says Morikawa. "I tried it on maybe the 13th hole. Felt great." I jokingly said, "I might have to take this." He wasn't kidding. Morikawa kept the putter and practiced with it extensively. He used the club at the Phoenix Open and finished 54th. The following week at Pebble Beach, Morikawa used the TaylorMade Spyder Tour X putter again and won for the first time on tour since October of 2023. "It's mine now," Morikawa declared after the win. That was just the latest in a long line of athletes notably borrowing, or borrowing in quotes, somebody else's gear and often finding success. 1912, Jim Thorpe. Prior to the 1500-meter race in the decathlon at the Summer Olympics in Stockholm, Thorpe's shoes were stolen. A teammate loaned him one. Where the other was a mystery, and he found another in the trash can. The one from the bin was too big, so Thorpe wore extra socks to get a better fit, and won the race by nearly 2 seconds to clinch his second gold medal of the Games. 1978, Bucky Dent. It's a well-worn story. Dent's famous homer against the Red Sox in the AL East playoff was hit with a bat belonging to teammate Mickey Rivers. But there's more to it than that. Rivers had originally borrowed the bat from outfielder Roy White, who was on first when Dent homered. He got there on a single he hit using a bat he borrowed from infielder Fred Stanley. 1994, Darryl Johnston. After Dallas won Super Bowl 28 in Atlanta, the gear belonging to the team's Pro Bowlers was shipped to Honolulu. One problem, the helmets were pilfered. The Cowboys fullback improvised, borrowing an extra from Packers QB Brett Favre. I had to pump in so much air in Favre's hat, I thought my head was going to float off, Johnston said after the NFC's win. 2010, Bobby Ryan. Late in the second period of a game against Anaheim, Mikko Koivu of the Wild lost his stick, so he forcibly borrowed the one being used by Ducks forward Ryan. When he realized he wasn't getting his stick back, Ryan picked up Koivu's and promptly scored with it, said Ryan. I just told him you took mine, so finders keepers, I guess. 2015-16. Kobe Bryant. Then there's the opposite of borrowing. Late in his career, as the Lakers were in the midst of a 65-loss season, the Black Mamba got fed up with the effort of his team's younger players. After a blowout loss, he sent an equipment man into the locker room with a garbage can to repo the shoes of any player, with the exception of a few veterans, wearing Kobe's Nikes. 2018, Esther Ledecka. The snowboarder surprised no one by winning the parallel giant slalom gold at the Pyeongchang Olympics. She surprised everyone, herself included, by winning the Super G. Ledecka was so lightly regarded in alpine events that she didn't even have skis. She borrowed a pair from Mikaela Shiffrin. Until today, she said, I thought I was a better snowboarder. And 2021, Daniel Camarena. The Padres called up the reliever from AAA El Paso on July 8. Since the minors use a DH, he didn't have a bat or batting gloves. So, Goseka Cato of the Chihuahuas loaned him some gear, which Camarena used to hit a grand slam off Max Scherzer. He then called Cato to ask for another bat. Not because he wanted more, says Cato, because they put that bat in the Padres Hall of Fame. And that's all the time we have for this edition of the Sports Show. My name is Steve Jack. Thanks for joining me.